This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
We're seeing more interaction between the venues, the sports venues, and the policymakers, where the sports venues are saying, help us set up a recycling program by bringing one to the community.
The business side of the American sports industry is the hidden underbelly, which, when exposed, can be rather distasteful. More and more, taxpayers are paying some of the world's wealthiest families to build the facilities that house these already profitable businesses we love to cheer for. But it's not all doom and gloom, according to this week's guest on Sea Change Radio, Alan Hershkowitz. A pioneer in the greening of the sports industry and a senior scientist at the NRDC, Dr. Hershkowitz is working to help decrease the carbon footprint of our nation's sports teams while engaging sports industry leaders to speak up about environmental problems like climate change. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Dr. Alan Hershkowitz. He's the director of the Sports Greening Project at the NRDC, and he's also a distinguished visiting professor in sports and sustainability at the Presidio Graduate School. Alan, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me on.
So many of us are sports fans, Alan, and when we're not actually watching the games on the field and we're reading about it, there's a lot of important work being done in the sustainability field revolving around sports. Why don't you first give us a quick snapshot of the history, which was like the leading edge sports league to first realize that the environment was something not to be taken lightly?
The first sports stadium greening initiative was carried out by the Philadelphia Eagles back in 2004. I worked on that project along with an organization called Sexton Associates and the Philadelphia Eagles football team's stadium management at Lincoln Financial Field. That, I thought at the time, was a one-off. About a year later, NRDC's trustee Robert Redford talked about the need for us to engage with professional sports in order to popularize the message about global climate disruption and biodiversity loss and ocean acidification in a non-political, non-controversial way. And also in a way that attracts the attention of Americans, because let's be frank, 13% of Americans follow science, 63% follow sports. You know, outside of the family, the most influential role models are athletes and entertainers. So if we could instigate a cultural shift in the way people think about the planet, the way people think about environmental stewardship, that's huge. In fact, I would argue that the single most important thing we could do to protect the Earth is to instigate a cultural shift in attitudes and expectations about how we have to relate to the planet. And it's becoming increasingly difficult for scientists to communicate about these issues, increasingly politicized. So the embrace of professional environmental stewardship by professional sports holds enormous opportunities. Bud Selig, the commissioner of Major League Baseball, was the first one. I wrote him a letter asking for a meeting right after talking with trustee Bob Redford a year after the Philadelphia Eagles football stadium was greened. I wrote the commissioner of baseball a letter, and he invited me in, and I met with his executive staff, the executive vice presidents at Major League Baseball, and the first professional sports league environmental group collaboration was formed between NRDC and Major League Baseball. And then that grew to a collaboration with the NBA and the National Hockey League and the U.S. Tennis Association and Major League Soccer, and also conversations with the NFL. And now we have a situation where every professional sports league commissioner has acknowledged publicly the need to do something about global climate disruption. All professional sports league commissioners are encouraging their venues and teams to think about energy efficiency and water conservation and recycling and composting. And the supply chain, you know, and this is being noticed in the marketplace. Remember, the sports industry is one of the largest industries on the planet.
And it's really a confluence of so many industries beyond just the social fabric that we find.
You're absolutely right. All industries meet on a professional baseball field. All industries meet on an NFL football field. All industries meet at an NBA game. The plastic industry, the food and beverage industry, the textile industry, the chemical industry, the energy industry, the transportation industry, the water industry, all of these industries are either suppliers to the sports industry or sponsors of the sports industry. And when the sports industry, when the commissioners of these leagues say, we want environmentally intelligent products, we want more energy efficient appliances, more energy efficient arenas, we want to figure out how to compost our food waste instead of sending it to costly landfills and incinerators, but the plastic packaging of the food waste is not compostable. Because of the messages coming out of professional sports, we're starting to see much greater research into compostable plastics that are often bio-based as well, hopefully based on residue, agricultural residues as a bio-based plastic, not crops, but residues. And this is all happening. We're seeing energy efficiency initiatives. We're seeing water conservation initiatives. We're seeing the use of toxic chemicals being evaluated and reviewed. We're also looking at food. The concessionaires feed tens of millions of people a month. They are now increasingly looking for healthier menus, meats without antibiotics being administered every day, local meats, local vegetarian and more vegetarian options and vegan options. So sports can help frame the marketplace in a very powerful way. Certainly it can't by itself solve our ecological problems, because no one issue can. No one undertaking can solve the ecological pressures of global climate change and ocean acidification and biodiversity loss and water scarcity and deforestation. These issues get addressed by millions of environmentally intelligent decisions being made.
So where are some of the most impressive gains being made, in your opinion, Alan?
Well, look, I mean, you know, you've got 19 professional stadiums and arenas that have solar power installations. You've got 15 professional stadiums and arenas that have complied with LEED, and that number is growing.
Why don't you explain what LEED certification means for our listeners?
LEED is a designation, an environmentally reward, an environmental reward for good design. It's called Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design. It's administered by the U.S. Green Buildings Council. It's one of the most successful, arguably the single most successful building certification protocol ever developed. And we're seeing more and more stadiums and arenas complying with LEED design and building standards. And that's a direct result of the green building, sports greening movement having influence throughout the construction of stadiums and arenas. So we're seeing a lot of, you know, actually there's installation of solar-powered electric car chargers. There's preferential parking being offered for hybrid and electric cars.
In your report, Game Changer, Alan, one of the main takeaways is that professional sports has proven the business case of sports greening. And whether we root for the team or not, these are businesses. And athletes, when they get cut or they sign a new contract, they always remind us that football is a business. It seems like that dollars have really been one of the motivating factors for making environmentally prudent decisions. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, that's a wonderful thing that's happened, is that right now it's a win-win in many areas. If you reduce your energy use and you become more energy efficient, you save money. But guess what? You also reduce your carbon emissions. If you reduce the amount of waste that you're producing and the amount of waste that you have to haul, you're saving money. Yep, that's a good thing. But you're also diverting material from going to landfills and incinerators. And when you divert materials away from landfills and incinerators because you're sending it to recycling and composting and you're able to save money, you're also helping to protect the environment. When you conserve water and you switch to waterless urinals or low-flow fixtures, you're saving money on water. Yep. But you're also helping to promote water conservation. So we're in a great situation now, and this is one thing that the sports industry has helped teach the marketplace, or, you know, or confirm for the marketplace, is that many environmentally intelligent operational adjustments are also economically justified, and the sports industry has helped make the business case for energy efficiency, for water conservation, for waste reduction, for composting and recycling, and you know, even for a reduction in the use of hazardous chemicals and their disposal. So you know, when we could get the marketplace to advance our environmental objectives, we win. You know, if we could outcompete the bad stuff, outcompete environmentally ignorant products with environmentally intelligent products, you know, people tend to buy products based on product price, product performance, and fashion. They don't buy products based on environmental criteria as much. That, you know, that's changing, certainly in the area of healthy food. People don't want to eat fruit that's saturated with chemicals or meats that have been saturated with antibiotics. But for the most part, you know, people buy products based on can they afford it and how does it work? Does it work the way they want it to work? And how do they feel wearing it or driving it? You know, so if we could build environmental intelligence into the products at the manufacturing level, we don't even have to worry about whether people, you know about the environmental features or not. If we've outcompeted the bad stuff in terms of environmental quality and price, we win. Sitting on a sofa on a Sunday afternoon, going to a candidate's debate. Laugh about it, shout about it, when you've got to choose. Every way you look at it, you lose. Where have you gone, Joe DiMaggio? A nation turns its lonely eyes to you. What's that you say, Mrs. Robinson? Joe to Joe has left and gone away. Hey, hey, hey. Hey, hey, hey.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Alan Hershkowitz. He's a senior scientist at NRDC and the director of the Sports Greening Project there. Well, you go around stadia all over the country, I imagine, Alan. Can you give us some of the shining examples of where change is being made? And then maybe on the flip side, where are some of the worst offenders?
You know, if you travel around the country, there's a lot of great stadiums and arenas to visit from an ecological perspective. At PNC Park in Pittsburgh, where the Pirates play, the ownership there, Bob Nutting, and he's got a spectacular team, they have really, you know, pioneered the composting of food waste at sports stadiums. They have committed themselves to finding composting markets and developing recycling infrastructure. They've got a great recycling and composting initiative going on in Pittsburgh at PNC Park. Safeco Field in Seattle is diverting over 90% of its waste, again, using composting and recycling. You see that in AT&T Park, spectacular example of composting and recycling.
Where the San Francisco Giants play.
Yep, in the Bay Area, yep. We're starting to see increasing use of meats without antibiotics, raised without the use of daily dosing of antibiotics. Again, the concessionaire center plate is working with AT&T Park. It's working with Safeco Field. It's working with Qualcomm Stadium, which is down in San Diego, on supplying fans with meats that are not routinely dosed with antibiotics, which is causing these super bacteria, and which the Center for Disease Control and the FDA and the American Academy of Pediatrics have all raised big concerns about the use of antibiotics in meats, and we're starting to see that being addressed. More increasingly, energy efficiency is happening throughout the country in the use of solar. You've got MetLife Stadium in New York. The LEED certification for the American Airlines Arena in Miami, the LEED certification for the Barclays Center in Brooklyn, the Levi's Stadium that's being built for the San Francisco 49ers will be the first one in the country to have a completely stadium-wide antibiotic-free hot dog. And the Moda Center up in Portland also has some of the healthiest food, and they are actually, they may become the first to provide an antibiotic-free hot dog. But again, they do spectacular recycling and composting and at the Moda Center up in Portland, and they have electric car chargers that for free, that are preferentially placed in terms of access to the arena. So they're trying to promote energy-efficient transportation, recycling, energy efficiency. The Staples Center in L.A. is spectacular in terms of water conservation. It's replaced 176 urinals, each one consuming 44,000 gallons of water a year. They replaced them all with waterless urinals, and they save over 7 million gallons of water a year, and they save money to boot, and they put solar panels on the roof. So, you know, the array of infrastructure enhancements taking place now in the professional sports industry at venues throughout the country, indeed throughout the world. I'm going to Europe in 2 weeks to meet to talk about green sports collaboration in Switzerland and in the UK. The movement is growing globally, as it needs to, because all industries need to respond to the urgent ecological pressures that we're facing. The Oscars that are going to be broadcast at the end of February, March 2nd this year, they have embraced environmental stewardship. We've been working with them for 8 or 9 years on energy efficiency work, on shifting to recycled paper. Remember, the paper industry is one of the biggest causes of global warming pollution, industrial causes.
Is this at the Oscars?
The Oscars are going to be using recycled paper. They're going to be composting their food. They're going to supply organic food. They're going to be using, they're going to be offsetting all the energy that's used at the event, at the telecast, at the red carpet event. All of that will be offset with Green E-certified carbon offsets by the Bonneville Environmental Foundation. The Oscars have been championing environmentally intelligent initiatives back since 2006. That's when I started working with them on this. And that has percolated throughout Hollywood. Again, these industries, you work on the Oscars, you work on the Grammys, there's a good chance that you're also working in one of the movie studios or TV production houses. And you take the lessons on greening of these jewel events. You know, jewel events are like the World Series, the Super Bowl, the Oscars, the Grammys. Greening of jewel events, which NREC has really pioneered and is doing more of than anybody, and we learn a tremendous amount about how to use those jewel events for outreach, fan engagement, and supply chain interaction.
Without insulting any of your colleagues, who's behind the curve in your estimation?
Yeah, well, I don't really, I'll tell you, I frankly, I just don't even think about it. I'm so focused on the positive and, and on sort of collaborations on moving things forward that wherever I go, whether I'm in Oklahoma or in Houston or in Miami or in Dallas, we're seeing progress all over the world in all venues.
But surely you see some kind of contrast in stadium to stadium. You'll be in Pittsburgh where they have a great composting program. Then you'll be in a place, let's say Sacramento, and they don't recycle at all. It's kind of a function of the community almost, isn't it?
You raise a really good point, and that's worth discussing, and that is that the recycling capabilities of a stadium and arena are governed by the recycling infrastructure of the surrounding municipality.
Houston, for example, I know their waste stream, their residential waste stream is like 10% recycled and composted, something extraordinarily low, while San Jose is around 85%. So that infrastructure is in place, and there's only so much a stadium can do.
Right. So if the surrounding community has a great recycling infrastructure, like it does in Seattle, like it does in San Francisco, then you're going to see very high rates, able to be accomplished by the arena, which makes sense. Similarly, New York, the New York Yankees are doing wonderful with regards to recycling diversion. They're actually they've got aspirations for a zero waste initiative, and they're introducing composting again at this year at the stadium. That's been helped enhanced enormously by the ability because of New York City's commitment to recycling and now food waste separation, which is a big deal. Where municipalities don't have that infrastructure, the arenas are limited. And that's why when arenas start to ask, when the professional sports industry starts to ask the localities to help set up recycling infrastructure, because it's going to save them money. I mean, we're seeing millions and millions of dollars having been saved just in Major League Baseball. By the enhancement of recycling and energy efficiency and water conservation. All of these things are saving the teams and the venues money. If you can't divert for recycling and composting, you're throwing money away and you're throwing away valuable resources. These teams don't want to be implicated in that, and they want to benefit financially from the opportunities that recycling provides. So we're seeing more interaction between the venues, the sports venues, and the policymakers, where the sports venues are saying, help us set up a recycling program by bringing one to the community. Similarly, you had the NBA, the National Hockey League, the U.S. Olympic Committee, and Major League Baseball all testify in front of a congressional committee, the Joint Bicameral Committee on Climate Change. They all testified about the fact that climate change was real and needed to be addressed. And, you know, here's, Major League Baseball and the NFL and the NBA and the NHL, they're not known, you know, to be, left-wing radicals or, right-wing extremists. So they come forward and, and they say, climate change is real and our businesses are paying attention to it. You know, that gets heard in Congress.
Earl the Pearl and Will Bingo and Jerry West play basketball at its very best. Basketball has always been my thing. I like Magic Bird and Bernard Kane. And number 33, my man Kareem is the center of my stoning team.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Alan Hershkowitz. He's a senior scientist at NRDC and the director of the Sports Greening Project there. Alan, you spoke earlier about your work with the Oscars, and you penned a piece about the greening of the Super Bowl, these jewel events, as you referred to them. That brings us to the most recent jewel event, the Sochi Winter Games. What lessons should the sports and sustainability movement learn from this?
Sochi Olympics suffered from a lack of transparency between the governing agency and the local government and the host country and the environmental community and the public at large. I mean, what you saw in London at the previous Olympics was a tremendous amount of transparency and open dialogue between the community and the public at large and the media about the issues surrounding environmental responsibility, environmental protection in the construction of the facilities, environmental intelligence built into the operations of the facilities, and of course the environmental legacy once the event is over. That kind of open transparency and dialogue was absent in Sochi, and as a result, we got less environmental protection. Because we had less watchdogs and we had less dialogue, and it's only through dialogue that we really could, actually learn. So there's a lot of waste management issues, lingering waste management issues. There was a lot of land conversion that was done in an ecologically insensitive way. There were meaningful efforts. I mean, the Dow company did attempt to offset a tremendous amount of the carbon emissions associated with the event, including all transportation-related impacts. And they performed a very, very comprehensive analysis, arguably the most comprehensive analysis of a global sporting event ever done when it comes to transportation and carbon. And then they set about putting in place real, meaningful offset technology and investments. So Dow did a good thing with the transportation infrastructure and the offsets at Sochi. But overall, I think Sochi will be remembered for a lack of transparency, a lack of respect for regulatory procedures and permitting features, that a lot of those things were just fast-tracked without the proper review.
I understand that there's some terrific stuff being done in these areas, but I think we're putting our heads in the sand if we ignore the policy that has allowed some of the corruption to happen, not just overseas, but in this country, with the funds being
misused. Like you talk about Bud Selig and Roger Goodell, and these are commissioners of our two biggest sports, and they probably have done some important stuff for environment, but we have to address the fact that some of this could be viewed as window dressing. I mean, they're a nonprofit organization or not-for-profit. The baseball has a 501c3 exemption from Congress, and NFL has a 501c6 exemption. And yet the commissioner of baseball made $22 million last year. Roger Goodell made $30 million of a nonprofit organization. I mean, if the NRDC executive director was making $22 million, you might roll your eyes, right?
All organizations at that scale are complex, and they're using their market and cultural visibility in a positive way on the environment. And as an environmental advocate, an environmental activist, an environmental researcher for the last 35 years, I welcome their attention to this issue, the use of their platform to educate the marketplace, to implement reforms at stadiums and arenas, to build a real lasting change into the operations of those very visible buildings, you know, in communities, you know, throughout the country.
Well, I think one of the reasons why it's easy to look the other way is because we all love sports. I love sports, and I don't want to think about my team doing social ills in any ways. But there's policy that goes into exempting the tax status of some of these stadiums. So, I mean, I know that there's great work being done, but if, for example, I think New Orleans, I know there's an inducement payment to Tom Benson every year, $7 million inducement payment to Tom Benson every year just to keep the New Orleans Saints, just keeping Benson from moving the Saints out of New Orleans. So that $7 million a year given to Tom Benson, who's a billionaire, I just think that those things should be put into the equation when we're talking about the environment. Don't you think some of that money could be used for some of the great efforts that you and your colleagues are working on? Because it's a cost-benefit analysis. You have to do it.
Municipal governments allocate their resources, you know, in various ways. Sometimes they do it, you know, for sewage treatment plants. Sometimes they do it for educational facilities. Sometimes they do it for a sporting venue. You know, sometimes they do it to, you know, to prop up a library or a bank. You know, that's part of, you know, the way economic development funds are allocated, you know, throughout municipal governments and state governments. I have not been spending my time, really, frankly, studying, you know, the mechanisms or the equity associated with various stadium financing activities. I really haven't. But that's not what I'm talking. That's not what I know about. I do know that there's environmentally harmful subsidies for overfishing and for chemical use in agriculture, and for, that promotes deforestation and the use of, a generation of nuclear wastes. There's a lot of environmentally harmful subsidies that skew the market against finding cost-competitive, environmentally intelligent products. That's an issue. And that's an issue people at stadiums and arenas, you know, are helping to try to, you know, reverse by making market demand for environmentally intelligent products. Because so long as, you know, the market does not ask for environmentally intelligent products, we're going to keep getting garbage. You know, we're going to keep getting materials that are not designed with recycling or waste reduction in mind. We're going to get packaging that's not designed with composting in mind. We're going to get energy wasting technologies.
So, Alan, you're actually teaching the nation's first graduate course in sports and sustainability. Tell us a bit about it, if you will.
One of the great things that's come out of this sports greening work is that the Presidio is going to be hosting a graduate business class on sports and sustainability that's going to be starting in the fall of 2014. They're actually offering a certificate program, so people who are operating stadiums and arenas or students who are getting degrees in sports management could get a certificate in sports stadium environmental management.
Terrific. And people can go to presidio.edu to learn more about it. He's a senior scientist at the Natural Resources Defense Council and also a distinguished visiting scholar in sports and sustainability at the Presidio Graduate School, Alan Hershkowitz. Alan, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
It's been a pleasure to talk with you.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Queen, The Meters, Simon & Garfunkel, and Curtis Blow.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others.
and tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.